Great pleasure and honor to introduce this week's colloquium speaker, Rainer Weiss. So Ray is one of those people who doesn't need an introduction, but I'm going to provide one anyhow. He did his PhD in physics at MIT and spent most of his research career as a professor at MIT. He's an emeritus professor now at MIT and also an adjunct professor at LSU. Ray got started working on atomic clocks and laser science, and then became interested in gravitational physics. He was one of the pioneers of measurements of the cosmic microwave background and co-founder of the COBE satellite project. But he's most famous for being the originator of the idea of using laser interferometry for measuring gravitational waves and being the co-founder of the LIGO project. And so this was a very long game, but in late 2015, it really paid off. and so now he is a winner of a very long list of prizes, which I won't repeat for you, but I can't resist mentioning just one prize that you might have heard of, which is the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2017, which he shared with Kip Thorne and Barry Barish. So I think I speak for everybody when I say that the discovery of gravitational waves is one of the most thrilling and impressive scientific achievements of our time. And the story of that discovery is really inspirational, and that's what we're going to hear about today.
Thank you very much.
Wow. Well, thank you for having me. I have had a wonderful set of days here. I have to say, this is probably one of the most convivial places I've been in. They feed you even. I mean, it's amazing what goes on. And then you don't have to rush around and people don't bother you if you don't have to be bothered. You want to be bothered, you find people to talk to. It's just a remarkable place, I have to tell you that. Okay? So, So I'm going to talk about what this is, and I have never given this talk quite the way here. I may get completely messed up in the timing because this is new to me. I'm going to tell you a little, not only about the detector and a little bit of history, which is what I usually do, but I also now, because things have happened, I have to tell you about what kind of things we've measured. That's new. And so that, I don't know how long that'll take, and I will keep looking at you. When you start falling asleep, I'll quit, okay? All right. Anyway, so first of all, let me quickly, since not everybody always knows what is everything, is let me tell you what a gravitational wave is, and in the most rudimentary way, so you will understand better the detector. And I'm going to point to the upper screen. I can't see a reflection from the lower one. Gravitational waves were a thing that came out of the Einstein theory, which came in 1915, but in 1916, and we'll talk a little more about it, and then again in 1918, he wrote a special set of papers about perturbation theory in gravity, and in one of those papers, the 1916 paper, he does a full treatment of gravitational waves. He makes a huge mistake in there, well, if you can ask me about it, but in the end, he makes some interesting statements that we'll get to, and then he corrects all of that in 1918, but what he in the 1916 paper, he shows you what a gravitational wave is. And here I want to quickly tell you exactly how you want to interpret this. This is going to start moving in a minute. That red dot, or that red square, is you. And these are things you've sprinkled out into space, and we're going to look at a plane wave. And the plane wave has the property that it moves at the speed of light, so it's going into that board or out of it with the speed of light. We now know pretty well it does that, in fact. And the other thing is it's a transverse wave, and what you're going to see here is what that transverse effect is. And let me turn this on. You'll get a little sick looking at this, but that, okay. And so here you are again, and what you'll notice is that the motion is a motion where there's an expansion in one direction while there's a contraction in the other. And the other thing that you'll notice is that the expansion motion, these little masses that you threw out and sprinkled into the wave, are moving more at a goodly distance from you, let's say like there and there, than very close to you. And in fact, that pattern that you see there is a pattern at any one instant of a thing that's characterized by a constant strain. Not in time, but the strain in that picture is the same all over the picture. The expansion is a strain and the compression is a strain. They're different signs. But change in distance of the spots divided by their separation is a constant. Okay? It's the same all over the picture. And that you exploit in making the detection. I hope I haven't said too much, but that's the thing you want to characterize these waves by, is that they distort space, and the distortion of space grows as the separation of the objects that are thrown into that space. That's all I want to, because that's fundamental to the way you might make the detection of these waves. Okay, now let me take you into the sort of a little bit of history, and I quoted here a thing that comes out of the 1916 paper. It's not important that you know what this equation is, but Einstein, at the end of the paper, refers to that equation, and what that equation is the strength of gravitational fields that are in the wave and some dynamics in the source. In this case, it's the third and second derivatives of the moment of inertia of a mass distribution. And the mistake he makes in that 1916 paper, and it's lovely to read it because it's so instructive, is he makes it so that you don't have to, every kind of motion, spherically symmetric motion, thing that looks like a balloon blowing up and contracting, will radiate gravitational waves in that more formulation. He doesn't have it quite right yet, but he has the numbers right. He has the numbers right, and that's what I want to show you. Because at the end of the paper, he says, if you look at this equation, and he says, you go through the paper and you see what these constants are. He says, in German, he says, and I'll read it to you in English, as the red is on in German, in any case one can think of, A, that thing, will have a practically vanishing value. In other words, right at the end of the paper, he says, you're never going to measure this, it's worthless. Okay? And why did he say that? I've asked the people who do the Einstein papers to go look in the notebooks to see if they can find somewhere in the notebooks the thing I'm about to show you. So I was a little presumptive here and decided to do it for you, but I can't be Einstein, you know. And so here's the relationships that in the second paper you get. And this is something which I'm just going to tell you about. H is that strain, that's the change in length divided by the length, that's the field quantity in the wave. And one way of saying what it is in a very crude way, it really comes from the formal quadrupole formula and all the stuff right, but if you want to estimate for yourself how big is the gravitational wave strain, you don't have to go much further than just use this. And here are the terms in it. That's the Newton's constant, that's the mass of the system that's doing the motion, and that's the distance you're away from it, and that's c squared, that's the velocity of light squared. I cannot work with c equal to 1. I just don't know how to do that. Okay, you guys know how to do that, you're experts at it, but not me. And so what happens is gm over r c squared is a quantity which is a very important quantity in the theory. It tells you how strong gravity is, the new gravity. And in this case, you're living in a place where gm over r c squared is about 10 to the minus 10. So you live in an absolutely minimal gravitational field. Tiny, even though your legs hurt when you go up a mountain, okay? So, and then you multiply that, because to get this far, you multiply that quantity, this field quantity, by the velocity divided by the velocity of light, the velocity of the system. And in our case, we have to always think of things which are not uniformly expanding and contracting. They have to have some sort of ellipticity. So Einstein must have done, when he made that statement, he might have thought, well, let's take two trains colliding with each other. Trains don't go any faster nowadays than they do then. Well, some places, but not in the United States, that's for sure. We have trains that come from the 1800s. Right? So you take a mass of 10 to the 5 kilograms, here are these two trains smashing into each other. They might have a velocity of 100 kilometers per hour. That's pretty good for most trains in the United States nowadays. They might collide in a third of a second. The smashing takes place. And you have to go out radiation zone. In other words, you have to go out far enough, just like you do in E&M, away from the induction fields. You have to get to a place where the fields are going down as one over the distance. So you have to go to 300 kilometers when you use times like that. And what H do you get? Well, you get a number which is really tiny. H to 10 to the minus 42. That's hopeless. It's absolutely hopeless. Even with the technology we have, it's just worthless. Cannot do it. So Einstein was absolutely right. This will never have any influence on anything that he could imagine. And there's another example over here. And that is that suppose you take a stellar system. That's something he probably did think about. And where you have two stars going around each other, and they're accelerating, and they radiate, and you just apply that formula again for the H. And so it picks some masses like a solar mass, pick an orbit period of a day, Although Einstein didn't know about the galaxy, but he could have probably guessed 10 kilolight years is not a bad number. He would have gotten a number like 10 to the minus 23. That's still small, but not hopeless. As we'll see, that's not hopeless. But in his day, it was hopeless. And with a period of half a day, because a thing like this always looks the same every time it goes halfway around, right? So it has to be twice the period, twice the frequency, half the period. So I still haven't said it right. The period is shorter by two for the gravity wave than the orbital motion. And you get, if you want to talk about the Q of a system, which is the energy stored divided by the energy lost per cycle, using that relation, you wind up with a Q of about 10 to the 15. Let's put that into something real. That says that if you look at these things through a telescope, it'll take you 10 to the 13 years. 10 to the 13 years before you can see that they've changed aspect, that they've gotten closer together. Again, hopeless. Okay, so that's the beginning of the field. I mean, and a lot of people then never paid much attention to this. That's absolutely true, and there were debates endlessly about whether it was real, whether they carried energy, and there were meetings and everything sort of thing. And a little piece of history I'll quickly go over is that there was an attempt made after 1957, when there was the Chapel Hill Conference in North Carolina, which was a watershed for this field. The experimenters finally got back into it. It wasn't just mathematicians or looking at general relativity. Some people who do real physics were actually trying to do something with this. And they, because the technology had changed and what we knew about the universe had changed. So you began to contemplate. And Joe Weber, who tried to make a detection with ideas that John Wheeler had, tried to make a big bar, I won't go into it. He tried this, he didn't see anything. And the thing that, and it caused a lot of stir, and a lot of people tried this also. But the idea that we now are using, and I want to dwell with you a little bit, and I'm going to explain a little bit more than you would like probably, is this one. This is the idea of using timing of light to do the measurement. And the idea is to use an interferometer. And I'll walk you through this one. This is the basic idea that now LIGO is based on, LISA is based on, virtually all the techniques except, well, pulsar timing in a way. Except is based on the idea that you time light or time electromagnetic waves. So the idea is you make a Michelson interferometer, and here's a laser, that's a modern thing you stick into this, and you hit a beam splitter, and that beam splitter is a device that passes some of the light through it, and some of the light gets reflected, it goes down to another mirror, and imagine the gravitational wave coming down on that, and imagine that little thing I showed you with the square in it, the red square, that's where you put the beam splitter, that doesn't move in that conception. And this mirror moves out, and this mirror moves in. While these are moving in opposite directions, the light comes back, and it cancels. We'll talk about that why in a second. And some of the light goes to the photodetector when there's a gravitational wave there. But when there isn't a gravitational wave there, you've made it so that this length and that length, those times, and that time in here are identical. So no light goes here, and all the light goes back to the laser. That's the beginning of the idea. But now I want to do one thing a little more subtle. Which is, I want to explain to you how, and if you bear with me, you will then understand how we get the sensitivity that's necessary with this device. So I've done a little more than that. I've shown you what actually happens to the electric fields of the light. So here, the laser light is this big red thing. That's the amount of carrier light that comes out of the laser. And the arrows tell you the direction in which that particular light is moving. So this light is moving, purple direction is moving in from the laser. All that you see there is the light of the laser. It hits the beam splitter, and there it hits, it still only has half the power, square root of two light in the amplitude, and it's heading toward that mirror. It hits the mirror, it comes back from that mirror, and lo and behold, look what's happened. If that mirror is being driven in a way, or the space between the mirrors is being driven by gravitational wave H's, then you will get sidebands on that light. That's something new to you, some of you. In other words, one way of thinking, when you wiggle a mirror and you wiggle it sinusoidally, you can think of it as changing the time, but also changes the structure of the fields that are leaving the mirror and that are leaving it. You get sidebands. They're called phase-modulated sidebands. They come right out of the theory. Just have a phaser go around and be wiggling back and forth, and you will get sidebands. And the sidebands have the property that they have the frequency. This axis is the frequency axis. There is the original laser light. One of the sidebands is a little lower frequency. That distance is the gravitational wave frequency. The other one is a higher frequency, but they have opposite signs. So that comes off this mirror, comes here. Now let's look what happens to here. Same old story. You send the light, it doesn't yet have modulation on it, hits the mirror. Remember, this mirror does the opposite of this one. When this one's moving in or the space is shrinking here, that one's expanding. Those sidebands now are the opposite phase. You notice the high-frequency sideband is positive, the high-frequency sideband there is negative. And it comes back, and they come back to this beam splitter. And here's the magic of a beam splitter. The beam splitter has an interesting property. If it didn't have this property, you couldn't conserve energy. And that is that one sideband, when you reflect it, makes no change in the sign of the electric field. That's this side. We'll call that the symmetric side. The other side of the beam splitter does flip the field around when it reflects. So it flips the sidebands, this guy and that guy, and it flips the field. And lo and behold, what you'll notice is here's the carrier is gone. That's all the light is gone. And what's doubled are the gravitational wave sidebands. And they make it back to the detector. In the meantime, what comes back to the laser is none of the sidebands and only the carrier. And so I want you to think that way. Because you exploit all these ideas in a minute to get the sensitivity you need. Excuse me. How many of you followed what I was doing? Wow. Congratulations. Okay, so along comes Kip Thorne. He says, if you want to do this and make this thing work, you got to do a lot better than just what I just told you. In other words, he's any kind of source that you might think of will at best have an H of 10 to the minus 21. I mean, when you think of what sources might be out there. And the strains, by the way, that Joe Weber was measuring and he thought he was measuring were about 10 to the minus 14, 10 to the minus 15. He couldn't have seen anything. He was a factor of a million off in sensitivity. So once you say that, and let's suppose you have a length of 4 kilometers, that happens to be the length of LIGO, you have to be able to and prepared to measure a distance of the endpoints moving by 4 times 10 to the minus 18 meters. And that is a huge challenge. And what is that challenge? It's a double challenge. One challenge is that you have to be able to measure the distance smaller than a wave by a factor of a million times a million, 10 minus 12 smaller than the wavelength of the light itself. But that's not the whole story. You have to figure out how to do that. But you also have to figure out how to make sure that these mirrors or whatever you have in there that's doing the reflecting don't move due to other reasons by more than 10 to the minus 10 to the minus 18 meters either. And the you and I are shaking in here by 10 to the minus 6 meters. So you have another factor of 10 to the 12 right there. So you have two big challenges, and that's what took so long. So here is the actual interferometer that made the measurement. First, I'll show you how the challenge was solved for getting this position sensitivity good enough. And then I'll show you how it was solved for getting the mirror not to move so much. And this is, now that you know a little bit about sidebands, you can see the subtlety of this. Here's the laser. What you know about already is the beam splitter. And there's that distant mirror that I had in the other picture. There it is again. But now a couple of things have been thrown into this. One of them is another mirror right here, which makes it so that the light that goes from the beam splitter spends more time. It bounces back and forth many times, about 300 times, before it comes out again. It's a crude way of speaking. It leaks out all the time. But on the average, that's about once it bounces back 300 times. You do the same thing over here. That way, the interaction of the gravitational wave making the sidebands grow and grow and grow. They get bigger and bigger. And so you do the same thing. Make sure they still spend the same time in both of these places. So that's the first trick. Bounce it back and forth many times. Then you take the light. Remember, none of the light went to the photodetector. Remember, all the sidebands went that way. But the light goes back to the laser. Well, you can't have that. It'll screw up the laser. So what you do is you put another mirror there. And that mirror sends that light back into the interferometer in such a way that no light gets back to the laser. Why does that happen? The laser light hits this. This is another mirror which is partially transmitting. So some of the light goes back. But notice that the light also goes through this. So the two light beams, the beam that has come from here and bounced off that mirror, added to the light that goes through that mirror, they cancel interferometrically. So that none of the light goes back to, you have matched the laser to the interferometer. That's a trick called power recycling. And then there's a subtle one which only you can understand, once you understand that there are sidebands there. fact is, and this is something that was first applied in advanced LIGO, you can take those sidebands and send them back into the interferometer also. And that gives them another crack at being modulated by the gravitational wave. That's a way of giving up a little bandwidth, but you get more sensitivity. And that's what this mirror does. So that's the signal recycling mirror. That is the basis that gets you that whole factor of a million. And here you wind up with the noise in that system. This is now the very first detector we built. And what you see on this axis is the frequency. And what you see here is the H, that H, but now as a spectral density. In other words, strain per square root of bandwidth. Unfortunately, you have to do that if you want to talk about noise. You have to talk about how much noise is in a given band. And you can see the things that dominate the noise. At least here is just the fact that you had dealing with photons and you can only measure the phase so carefully. This part is one part of the quantum noise. There is another piece of the quantum noise right there. If you now want to have a better measurement of the phase, you use more and more photons. But as you do that, you kick the mirror around more and more. The mirror becomes a giant Heisenberg microscope. That's what it becomes. In other words, you want to measure where it is very carefully, use more and more laser power, you have more photons, average better. But then as you do that, you disturb the mirror more. So that this thing here is the quantum limit. That's the quantum limit. And the first detector was not limited in quantum ways in the places where the forces matter, but it was limited by the phase noise. And then there are other noises. For example, this noise, the fact that everything's room temperature and just shaking, and we had these mirrors supported on, we'll see that in a minute, off pendula, that's the thermal noise, just the Brownian motion, because we're operating at 300 degrees. And then lastly, here's the one, of course, that we all know about, and you know too, is the seismic noise, is the ground noise. And so that's the envelope of this curve. And there's some things here which are worth noting. One of them is you have to have a vacuum, and the reason you have to have a vacuum over very long paths is because the scattering of the molecules cause phase fluctuations in the light. And so that's the same as index fluctuations. So you have to pump the system down. That's what costs all the money. And our system is some down here. Does not figure in the noise budget. And I'll pick one other remaining noise, and this is important. This is a very important noise, this one here. And we'll talk a lot more about seismic noise in a second. But this is the noise that's due to the fact that even though you might have been able to get rid of the ground noise by making fancy tricks, the thing you can't get around is that ground noise is generated by seismic waves, acoustic waves in the ground. And they cause the density of the ground to change. So if, let's say, this thing right there is the mirror, and a sound wave is traveling through the ground, which is changing the density of the ground, and it gets a little denser near here, and then it gets refracted, it gets expanded there, it's pulling the mirror over to the ground by just plain old Newtonian forces. So you can't beat that. You can't put something in the way. You're stuck. And that happens both in the ground and it happens in the atmosphere. And that is combined, and this curve is a steep curve. So you notice it just gets very, very hard to beat this at very low frequencies. And that's the reason why LISA exists. LISA doesn't have that problem. LISA is out in outer space. So that gives you sort of an envelope of the kind of things you have to work with. I won't dwell on this because otherwise I won't get to the sources. But let me just say this much. These are the tricks that we've done for advanced LIGO. And you'll see what they did in a minute when I show you a spectrum of advanced LIGO vis-a-vis the initial LIGO. And the first trick is this: to get rid of the ground motion, you attach the ground to these springs up here. That's a pendulum. You hang another pendulum from that pendulum. You hang another pendulum from that pendulum. And finally, here's the mirror that's now very nicely isolated. But from all these things with four pendula. Remember, in a pendulum, what happens is you have the top point. And if you hear, this is the mirror. And if these are together, at very low frequencies, they move together. You can demonstrate that to yourself in your own dorm room or wherever you are. They move slowly. But if this moves fast, this doesn't move at all. That's the key. And so you get filtering at high frequencies for each pendulum stage. And so that's one thing. And then there's a fancy thing, which I'll only describe to you. But how many of you use earphones that, when you go on an airplane or you're in a noisy place, you use earphones that kill the sound from the outside? These noise-canceling earphones? That's exactly what that is, another trick that's done. This is a very important trick. It's a trick that you actually measure the seismic noise on a platform. You measure it with a very good instrument, and then what you do is you push the platform to cancel the noise on the instrument. That's the same thing what those earphones do. And that's a big trick that was done in advanced LIGO, made a huge difference. And so now let me get to where we are with this, and I want to point out something to many of you who are calculating and becoming interested in LIGO ought to know what I'm about to tell you now. So this picture is a picture of frequency this way, and H of F again this way, but these are the actual performance of the instruments. The top one is the advanced Virgo detector, which ran with us toward the end of the run. And this is the advanced LIGO detector right there. And that's the one that made many of the discoveries. And here is where advanced LIGO design of that detector should be. Look at this. It's right there, that green line. You see it? That green line is not on top of the purple line by a goodly amount. And we don't understand why it isn't. So we have to lurk on that detector. That's what we're doing right now, trying to get it to the point where it's at design sensitivity. And since the sensitivity is the key variable in the gravitational wave detection, you bear with us. Please bear with us. Because if we improve it by what it's there, we increase the sensitivity by, let's say, a factor of, call it 2, 2.5. It depends on what wavelength it is. And what happens is that increases the rate of transient events, like the black holes and the neutron stars, by not 2, but by 8. Because you're looking twice as far into the universe, and you're seeing 8 times that volume. So the number of sources you have is 8 times larger. So that's a worthy goal. It's much better than just sitting there and running longer. We have to run. But if you can see how to make a factor of even 1.5 improvement, that's always worth doing that over running, if you can do it. Yeah, I know there are limits and there are wonderful things. I won't go into the other lines. We'll talk about that later. So now here's the distribution of detectors and some of them are still not there, but the two that made all the three that made all the noise you're going to hear about, that's the one in Louisiana. That's the one in Washington State. These are the LIGO detectors. Then there's a Virgo detector in near Pisa in Italy. And then there's a research detector that isn't really part of the data taking, but it's a place where a lot of ideas are developed. That's in Germany. That's called the GEO detector. And these are detectors that are in the process of being built. And that's one is Kagra, which is in Japan. And then there's a LIGO detector, which was at Hanford, is now being put into India. And these things will be ready I expect this will be ready in the middle 20s. The Japanese have a schedule I don't understand, and I'm not going to tell it to you. They think they're ready tomorrow, and that's just not reasonable. Okay. So here, let me quickly give you a tour of LIGO, and this very fast. This is just LIGO looking down on it in Louisiana. That's LIGO looking down on it in Hanford. And you can see the beam tube envelope. That's that big concrete cover for the beam tube. You can see it's green. It must be Louisiana. That's the beam tube itself. And that's a big thing. I won't go into the technology of that. That looks like a lot of the laser tables. I'm sure you have the University of Ottawa here. University of the university here yourselves. This is people learning how to run the instrument in the control room. So it's a big place, a lot of stuff. Okay, now we get to the things that were detected. And I want to dwell on this a little bit because it has a lot. It's no longer I had a conversation with Luis this morning. Where's Luis? Yeah. And we agree on one thing. We were super, super careful. And the reason we were super, super careful is because of the early history with Joe Weber and the fact that $1 billion had been spent on this thing. And we couldn't screw up. If we did, that would be bad for all of you in the room, okay? So we couldn't do that. So we had a very, very rigid set of conditions that things had to match. I'm going to give you those conditions. And Luis and I this morning talked about, when are you going to drop those conditions? I think we're getting used to it. We're getting a little closer now to dropping a few of them. That makes it a little more interesting. We'll look at things which we're not completely sure of. At least we won't miss something important. I'm hoping people in the LIGO collaboration are thinking that way. I certainly am thinking that way. So here's before we had the detection, we had these conditions. Whatever you saw in Livingston, you had to see it in Hanford. If it wasn't the same, that's it, out. Within the noise, you can't be absolutely the same. The waveform had to be not coincident. What you saw as you thought was a gravitational wave could not be coincident with a whole bunch of other measurements of the environment. And I list them there, I'm not going to go through them all. But there are many things in the environment. We have sensors for all these things in the environment. And if it was that killed it. And lastly, and this is the thing that really is so marvelous for an experimenter, this experiment was beautifully instrumented so that you had something like 100,000 signals coming out of this instrument everywhere. the laser frequency, the laser amplitude stability, the twist of a mirror, the plumb line of, I mean, every kind of parameter we had measurements for. And if any of those looked anomalous at the time when we had a signal, that they might not have nixed it, but we certainly would have investigated if it infected the signal. So we had, as best as we know, the control of the experiment. And that's something which no small investigator, now I couldn't have had in my laboratory at MIT. Nobody could have had. This was an expensive, big engineering effort to do that. So then you know this, I'm just doing this because this is the first thing we measured. That caused all the excitement back in 2015, and you've seen this many times. And but what it is again, that's Livingston, and that's this. This is a waveform. This is now H, and you'll notice that it's about 10 to the minus 21 up there. And the period, the times we're talking about are short, sort of two-tenths of a second is the thing. And you see a waveform that's not, they're almost the same at the two sites. When you fix it, you have to fix it. And if you have to make it because one of the sites has a negative sign in it, you have to fix that. And the other thing you have to fix is that one, it comes to one site earlier than the other. It came to the Louisiana site first, came seven milliseconds later, it was at the Hanford site. That told you where it was coming from. And so at least enough told you it was coming from the southern sky. And then we have some theoretical waveforms, which are now come from numerical relativity. You do many, many waveforms, you make a match to them, to the signal, you do a least squares fit in effect of the waveform to a theoretical waveform. That was one way it's done. I'll talk about other ways in a second. And then you take a residual, and that residual is pretty white. I know that people have worked on that residual in Denmark and found it not to be white. It turns out it is white, but let's leave it go. And then the nice thing is this picture, which you'll see over and over again for the different sources we've now seen. This is frequency. Frequency, that's 30 hertz, and this is 500 hertz. And then here's the time, and you have this from the black holes you have, or we didn't know at the time it was black holes, but it matches a black hole. Is you get a chirp. And that's a very fast chirp at these two sites. And this is sort of the interpretation of what we were seeing. The reason why this doesn't look the same as this, and a lot of people have asked me that. Look, this looks like it's growing, and this one looks like it's much flatter, and that's because a filter has been applied to the raw signals to cut out the bass and the treble noise. That's all that's been done. That's why they're not, but the fitting was done with that filter in mind. And so here's the gee whiz stuff that comes from this. They're the two black holes at the time, far closer. Eventually they make one black hole. And here's a nice gee whiz thing. Look, here's the velocity, the relative velocity of two guys. And this is the velocity of light, 0.6 the velocity of light. They're really getting closer and they really are moving fast. So here are things, 30th mass of the sun moving at what I would call fundamental particle speeds. I mean, it's sort of unbelievable. And we'll talk a little more about the energetics in a second. Here, I just want to say something about the data analysis, and I know that John Moffat was interested in this. We just talked about it. The data analysis was done two ways. It was done, one way was by using one detector as the filter for the other detector, and that's what this first thing I'm going to show you is. You'll see it on the right, and this is a little animation of that. You slide the signal from one detector over the other and look for the maximum correlation. And that is model independent, almost model independent. And then what you see there is a maximum in the cross-correlation function in that bottom picture. And what it gives you is a plot that's on the left here. This is the probability of the event versus the signal noise, effectively. And in this, you see this big event that when we saw at a signal noise of the cross-correlation of the noise of the detector, we see one of them. And that is, well, it was the detection by this method. The one we do most of our detection with is this method. I won't bother to show it to you, except, well, I'll start it, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. It's really the correlation of the signal in one of the detectors against a template. And we have many, many template banks. And you can see that's where the reason why this is a better method, if you think you know what you're doing, is you're measuring the noise in the instrument and the signal in the instrument against only a signal in the template. You don't have to worry about a noise in the template. The template may be wrong. That's a separate issue. But that's not the question you're asking at that moment. That comes as a separate question later, what's the chi-square of that fit to that template? And there you find new things, and then you, because you're not dealing with that extra noise, you find that same source that we had, but we found some other guys. This guy, we didn't even know about when we do the cross-correlation with against the two detectors against each other. And so here is another one of these. This is what we found in, I don't think I want to dwell on that. That's just a, now I say, oh, that's just another black hole. Come on. Wow, come on. You know, how our attitudes change. It's just amazing. And but here is sort of the interesting picture. This is sort of up to the triple detection with Virgo. This is what we had. There is the, this is time, this is H again, and this is that first one that made all the trouble, and that was maybe a marginal detection, that's a certain detection to get out of the waveforms, that's the one we were just showing you, and I just want to put one piece of numbers together, and this is acute so you can understand, I didn't dwell on the pointing theorem in that first slide, but this gives it to you in a better way than anything I can think of. Suppose you've taken those two black holes and put them at the position of the sun, at 1 AU, okay, and you let them do their thing. What would you have, had you felt anything? Would anything happen to you? Zilch. Because the strain at the Earth would be 10 to minus 6. You can't tell whether you have micro, several hundred centimeters long, and then you're looking at 10 to minus 4 centimeters. You wouldn't even know it, the size, less than a hair. You might hear it in your ear. You might just barely hear it in your ear. But what went through you is unbelievable. What went through you is a intensity of 10 to the 25 watts per meter squared. Compare that to what the sun puts out. It's 1,000 watts per meter squared is what the total solar constant is. So it's 10 to the 22 times more than the sun puts out on its own. Can you imagine a thing like that? It's just unbelievable to me. All this tells you is gravitational waves are enormously energetic, but they don't do anything. That's what it tells you. Again, another piece of evidence of Einstein and so forth. So it's just, and here is sort of, now we get into what just happened. What just happened, this is the position in the sky of the ones before Virgo made their detection with us. And then here's Virgo's, this is a triple one that happened in this golden month of August of this year. Everything happened in August, I don't know why. Here it is, and this is now the same kind of pictures you saw before. This is Livingston, this is Hanford. There is a signal in the Virgo detector. It's not big, but it's there, and you can see it. And what it does is, the interesting thing it does is it changes the whole aspect of how you localize on the sky. Here it was with LIGO alone, and then here you add Virgo, and then you add a little more to it, but you do a little modeling. You can get the thing down to from thousands of square degrees down to 30 square degrees. And that makes a difference for astronomers if they're going to chase and find out what this is. You're not telling them it's the whole damn sky you've got to look at. It's a certain region. And that comes back in a minute in spades when we talk about the neutron star. So the fact that you want more detectors is absolutely critical because it allows you to localize better and tie the gravitational wave sky to the electromagnetic wave and also particle sky. So here's a little picture that was made, that sort of cute picture, that's nice advertising. All the black holes we've detected, you can see them. I mean, these are the black holes that people have detected prior to us. This is the mass scale, and this is time, I guess. And you can see that all these big guys, they're a little different. They're very different than these black holes people knew about already. They're not the same size stellar black holes. And so consequently, there may be a different class and people of where they come from, when they were first made, are they made in globular clusters? Are they made in common envelope? A whole bunch of questions have occurred to astronomers and to us and to you as well. And these are interesting questions that will eventually get answered when we get more and more of these guys, okay? All right, so here's the next thing. This is actually very different. This is this thing that happened also in August. And this is the neutron star collision that we spotted in, I don't remember the day, it was in that same month, the 21st, I think it was. And here, what you see at the bottom is the actual same kind of thing, the time series, but this time you'll notice the time scale is a lot longer. And here's this very beautiful chirp. I mean, it's a chirp, it's a glissando. You go from the bottom of the piano and all the way up to about C above middle C, and you stop there. That's about, you do that, so you don't have to do it very fast, and just do it and you'll hear this. And so what happens is, and then it was seen also in an X-ray, in a gamma ray emission. And in other words, the Einstein, the Fermi mission. And so here it is, and here's the place when they would, we didn't, could not get to the endpoint. Our detector wasn't good enough at a kilohertz, where this is, a kilohertz is up in there. The endpoint is right there, and about 1.7 or 2 seconds later, there is this pulse that is seen in both the integral and also two channels on the Fermi detector. And that was a significant point for everybody. And the thing that's interesting about it is we were not able to tell people where it was right away. And this is the reason we weren't able to do it. And this is a picture, again, here are the three pictures that we have after the disaster here, which I'll tell you about in a minute, was taken care of. Here is Hanford, Livingston, and here's Virgo. And Virgo, you can't see it. And that's important, it turns out. They should have seen it. They had the sensitivity to see it. And that told us something. We'll get to that in a second. So now what happened here was that we had this terrible piece of dust or something that fell through the beam in Livingston. So there's the thing, and there was this poof, went through, and then it continued on afterward. So we felt that we could do that. We could take that pulse out. But all our automatic triggering stuff said, this ain't a detection. Because of that rule I told you about, it had to be seen in both places without disturbance. So we were late in getting this out to people. We only after people had to look by hand to look at this thing, and they say, oh my God, human beings, they are better to tell, yeah, that's junk. And so people started taking it out of the junk, and that right away, it took about 2 hours to get rid of the junk. And we feel entitled to do that. So this is what came of that. What came of it is that here, after we did that, here then is, again, a sky map, and the sky map is the best we could do with LIGO alone, both LIGOs together, are these big, you know, green band here and a green band there. Here is where the Fermi satellite put it, okay? And then if you took an integral, which is another one of these pieces of another X-ray satellite, a gamma-ray satellite, you got a big thing like that. And finally, if you included the fact that Virgo did not see it, it was in a null point of the Virgo antenna pattern, which is what you could see. You then got it into this smaller green thing. And lo and behold, astronomers within about 8 hours or 6 hours found this. They saw a spot right there in this galaxy, NGC 4493. They'd never seen that spot there before. Here it is 20 days earlier. It's not there. And they found that, and then a whole slew of astronomers. I mean, I've never seen so many astronomers tout their wares. It was really wonderful. And everybody saw it, okay? And it became a real, very interesting thing. I won't dwell on this slide, but this slide is intended to show. It wasn't just optical astronomers. Infrared astronomers saw it eventually, and then gamma ray astronomers had already seen it. X-ray astronomers saw it after a while. Radio astronomers saw it, and it was a real big piece of science. Everybody got into this. And it is really, truly the beginning of multi-messenger astronomy. I won't go into details. You can ask me about that in the questions. But what was it? And this is, again, a model. People think it was two neutron stars colliding. That's these two guys there. They eventually will form a black hole, but before they do that, they form some nuclear matter. And in that nuclear matter, there's real electromagnetic interactions, and you can see things. There's, because there's baryons in that thing, and it makes a display. And that display also has in it, and this is the part that I don't think is well established. It's established statistically, but it's not established with spectral lines. And that worries me some, but it's established in the following way. People know they see certain collections of in filters, and here's sort of what they saw. They see this is time over here, and each of these are, the colors go with the bands. This is the time series, and then the brightness in different color. This is a UV or near UV blue. It gets you slowly working into the green. And then the very reddish things, which are very low lower energy, you can see they last a very long time. Piecing that puzzle together, and that's been done by Ido Berger and by Brian Metzger, who had done a lot of the theory earlier. They then concluded that they had seen a process in the neutron star collision, which is called the R process, which is the process which makes all, and now they think, and I can't prove it one way or the other, they believe that the numbers are good enough so they can say most, if not all, of the heavy elements that are heavier than lanthanum were in the periodic table are not made in supernova, they're made in neutron star collisions. And they, at least in our galaxy, it seems that when they do the arithmetic for the amount of the very heavy elements, including this, everybody got very excited about gold and platinum. oh boy, should we go out there and mine it, you know, that kind of stuff. And no, I mean, that stuff was there too. So that's what's made, and that was it. And I don't want to go into this slide. I can tell you what else is there. What else is there is that if you could get a beautiful waveform, if you could match the waveform, and this is a piece of science which is really worth doing, and that people are trying very hard to do it. But and they probably won't get another chance to do this as well, but they weren't quite ready with the data. They weren't quite ready yet. And Luis was telling me that they weren't really not ready yet to do this right, but is to look for the following. Look for, as these neutron stars get very close together in that expansion, which comes out of that chirp. That chirp has deviations in the phase evolution of the chirp, due to the fact that one neutron star is getting close enough to the other to deform it, to make it not round, but make it slightly ellipsoidal. And that ellipsoidalness does two things. It puts some friction into the system, and also it changes the force law. It isn't just, it's gravity, but it's not gravity between two points anymore. It's extended objects. And that changes the evolution of the orbit. And that tells you something about the stiffness of nuclear matter, which would be a fascinating thing to learn. People would love to know what's the, how am I, when you compress, how does the density change? So that's something that's in the offing. It may very well be, if people analyze the data, that still has to be analyzed well. They were not able to do it yet, and I'll tell you what was screwing them up was they didn't have a model for both the nuclear, all the different equations of state and nuclear, there are many of them, I don't know, at least 30 of them. And then they didn't yet have to know how, with general relativity together, do the spinning neutron stars along with the different equations of state. That problem has to yet be solved in some very good numerical way so they can get this piece of thing out of the data. Another thing which is sort of cute that came out of it was, and something that also looks to the future somewhat, is this picture. That came from the group, in fact, the leader of that group is where you're going to be working. Daniel Holtz pushed this very hard. And what it was is that you now had a way of getting a Hubble constant in an independent way. And the idea was that you have now a thing where you know you can solve for the masses, you can solve for the H, you can solve for all the properties. So you know the dynamics at the source, the Einstein equations, and the way that you get from the Einstein equations. You also get the fact that the field is going down, when H is going down is one over the distance. So you have a known object at a given distance, and you can know you know what that distance is, and you know the object. Now, if you can identify something near it that has a Z value that's been measured by, let's say, spectroscopy, which you did have from that galaxy, you have an independent way of measuring one term of the Hubble constant without Cepheid variables, without all the multiple steps. You can do it right directly with that one system. And that's what was done here. Here's the Hubble constant, and this is the probability, and this curve, now these are the two values of the Hubble constant right now, one from Adam Riess and another one from WMAP or Planck, it's the same. Oh, they're not the same, but from the cosmic background. And here is, it's not very accurate yet, but here is the curve that group that worked on this thing using just the neutron star, does that argument I just gave you, they get a number that's sort of between them, but it's pretty broad. It doesn't settle the argument, of course, whether those disagree or agree. But more of these could settle the argument, and that's the idea that they're trying to show you. So, okay, so quickly, I want to quickly talk about, by the way, can you bear another 5 minutes? I mean, there's lunch, right? I mean, you have to eat lunch, right? Okay, should I go 5 minutes more? I mean, it could be 8 minutes, I mean, but that, okay. The thing is, I want to talk to you about other things that are not so famous, that come out of this. And that's a list of them. And I won't read you the list except to tell you that the top items are all these compact binaries. Clearly, that was the thing that we've now discovered. I remember that August. In August, I said to my colleagues, well, you know, we just discovered a neutron star binary. He says, well, goddammit, you ought to get a supernova. Tomorrow, we'll get a supernova, okay? Well, we didn't, okay? But that's another big thing to find. It'd be lovely to be able to see what goes on inside of a supernova, because that's what you get when you look at it with gravitational waves. You find out what the actual mechanics is, what the dynamics is inside the thing. You can't look at it. And E&M won't let you look in there. But the gravity waves, because they don't interact with anything, just come right out and you can look right in. So it's wonderful. But it's going to be a very exciting day when we see a supernova, because that's been a problem that's been with us for years and years. And then, of course, all sorts of other things like periodic, I won't go through the whole list. People are looking for untriggered sources, sources that anything you don't understand, all of these things you have to do by cross-correlating the detectors if you don't have a model. If you have a model, you can do the same kind of thing we've been already doing. And then people have been looking for a long, long time at periodic sources. And I'll show you something about those in a second. I learned here from Azamina that she has a new source, or you guys have all thought of a new source, which sounds very exciting. That black hole could become a CW source, which I didn't. I should read the literature. That's my problem. But if I had read the literature, I would have known, but I don't read the literature well enough. So thank you for telling me that. And anyway, so then people are looking for stochastic backgrounds of different kinds. Most likely they'll be seeing, and I'll say a little more about that. So let me quickly show you a little, some data you may not have seen. These are not official publications, but this is stuff compiled by Keith Riles. This is the periodic sources, and I'm sorry that it's so woolly and so badly out of focus. But I think this is about 100 hertz right there. Yeah, that's 10 hertz. And that's an H of about 10 to the minus 26, 10 to the minus 25, I believe. And this is the places where, these are all different pulsars. And this is what you would expect to see, a gravitational wave, if the ring down, or the spin down of the pulsar was all due to gravitational waves and not electromagnetic interactions, okay? So that's wishing a lot. But there are plus a couple of places down here now with the data, especially these guys, where there's both an orange thing around them and a gray thing in them, where you have gotten a data, an upper limit from a gravitational wave measurement, where it has said it's already down, you're near or below the spin down level. So we're beginning to get into the region where it might be interesting to find some of these CW sources. No, nothing has yet been seen there. There's an interesting thing over here on the right, though, which is a different technique. I call it the radiometer technique, and let me quickly tell you what that is. It's, again, something you might want to think about. It occurred to several of us, Al Lazzarini and me and others, that maybe one way to analyze the data is not to look at the frequency so much, but always to co-add points in the sky that are in the same place. Just add up, you know, always take a reference point and always add up whenever you, the beam pattern, and there is a somewhat of a beam pattern, when that maximum points to that point in the sky. Keep adding up always when the detectors point that way. And well, one of the sources that could do that, that'd be interesting, is Sirius. Scorpius, rather. That's an X-ray source, and it's known to have a black hole in it. And here is sort of the attempt. This is called the radiometer measurement. Here is the noise in the measurement. People begin to think that you keep co-adding, and this is now, these are different ways of doing that co-addition. But this could very well be sort of a limit some people are thinking about, where you might begin to see something due to the orbital motions inside that Scorpius X1 source. It's just a guess. It's just another way to analyze the data, and using this technique that all you guys are now thinking about, you especially are thinking about, where you co-add data on top of, in amplitude, not in power. This is happens to be in power, but you do it better in amplitude. The other thing that's going to happen is that people will see a stochastic background, probably, and this is what this picture shows. It shows as frequency. This is a picture from Vukmandic, and what's in this picture is, if you take all the black holes we already know about and distribute them uniformly, you might get and this is in the run 05, which means that we have come to, and this is important, that means we have come to design sensitivity. That's what that says. And if you come to design sensitivity, you would get, and this is in a closure density measure, in other words, here's 10 to the minus 10 of closure density, 10 to the minus 9 of the spectrum in closure density. This is the band that you get if these things are distributed, if these 30 solar masses and all the black holes we've now been seeing, you would expect to see, if you, with that detector, you should be able to see in this band, in that frequency band, the noise, effectively, of unresolved black holes due to background noise in the gravitational wave signal. And that's something which looks like might be in the cards. Okay, so now I think the last thing, I'll show one more slide of that, but I just want to show you what happens if you add LIGO India to this. And that's what this slide shows. This is now in the position on the sky. This is improved signal noise with three detectors. That's Hanford, LIGO, and Virgo. And these will be running. And as you improve in time, the little patches, these things are sort of the error circles. But if you add LIGO India to it, which is in a different latitude, different place, you really get down to the point where you're getting down the moon size uncertainties. And that's quite valuable if you want to see things and correlate them against correlate them against the electromagnetic sky. I do want to now say something about the other curves in this picture so you know what's ahead. And that is that we talked about in that picture up to this green line, which is the advanced LIGO design, and that we want to make. Okay, and this is, again, remember, this is spectral density of H, and this is frequency. Here's 100 hertz, kilohertz. And these are ideas that, this is the closest idea. We have an idea of how to improve things in the same facilities, the 4-kilometer facilities, so that we call that A+. That's plus on advanced LIGO, which gets us another factor of about 1.5, maybe 2, and that's its envelope. And that could be ready in the middle 20s, if we make design sensitivity with a LIGO. Remember, the design sensitivity for advanced LIGO is a screen line. And then there is another idea, which is, I won't go into all of it, but there's an idea that people are thinking about right now, especially Rana Adhikari at Caltech. It's called Voyager. It's a way of, I won't go into all the things it does. It gets around some of the noise problems that we expect to still have. But you can see it gets you another factor of about 2.5. And that could happen in the later part of the 20s. And the thing that a lot of people are thinking about, the Europeans are thinking about, and we are thinking about, is a completely new facility on the ground, which is in Europe, it's a 10-kilometer equilateral triangle that's buried. And the burial may help a lot with that Newtonian noise I told you about earlier in the talk. The people at LIGO are more, and especially Matt Evans, and I recommend that you get Matt Evans sometime to come and talk to you, because he's actually thought about this much deeper and more deeply than I have. He's to build a 40-kilometer long detector. That's this thing right here. So here's this is the sort of envelope for the 10-kilometer triangle people in Europe are thinking about, a buried triangle. And this is the envelope for the 40-kilometer surface detector called Cosmic Explorer. And with that, you can do some really quite spectacular things. Look, it's $1 billion just into the vacuum system unless we figure out a better way to make vacuum systems, okay? It's not something you get for free, but it's possible to do it. And here's one of the things. Just this picture tells you a little already what you would get if you could do this. What there is different models of this, and what this is a picture of is binary black holes, signal noise in binary black holes versus redshift of 30 solar mass binary black holes. And look, you can go out to a Z of 10, and you still have, the blue one is the one I showed you the picture for. You get about a signal noise of 100 out to Z of 10. That's spectacular. If you want to think of the science, you might be able to do with that. And you eventually, with one of that kind of detector, could, with things we already now know, you could do a survey of the whole universe in black holes, the entire universe. So that's something that's worth thinking about and what kind of problems you could solve with that. You might not be able to do cartography. That's a separate thing. People have thought about that. You know, the A and A dot. But you can certainly find out whether those black holes came primordially or if they came with the population 3 stars or where they actually came from. It'd be a very interesting thing to do. And this is sort of the last thing I'll show you. That's the end slash slide. This is the future of all the field, as far as we know. And I'll just walk you quickly through this, and that'll mean lunch, OK? However you want to do it. Then here's LIGO. This is frequency. That's H. And here's the LIGO, and here's LISA. That's the satellite. And that it covers periods of hours to minutes. Here's what we've already talked a little about, the idea of pulsar timing, which is a very interesting thing to do. It's a matter of using all the fast pulsars, use as many as you can get. And CHI will help with that enormously, I think. So will the square kilometer array. And that you're looking at gravitational waves that are coming at much lower frequencies, coming through our galaxy. And what you're looking for is a pattern of timing of these pulsars. The ones up go fast, the ones down go fast, the ones that go on the left or west, they go slower, the ones on the east go slower. You're looking for quadrupolar patterns in the timing of many pulsars. And that tells you about the existence of gravitational waves between you and the rest of the galaxy that come through the galaxy. Fascinating thing to do. And then lastly, which I won't dwell on right now, is the B modes of the cosmic background. I hope. I know there are people that don't believe in it. I don't know what to believe. But I think it's an experiment that certainly is worth doing. I've certainly advocated that. And it's being done with a vengeance. In many, many places, it's going to be doing a lot better than what done with BICEP. BICEP was an anomaly, but the detectors they developed were not an anomaly. They were wonderful. And they are now being used in things which have multiple wavelengths, which was the thing that they were missing in BICEP. So they may yet this bicep may yet see evidence for inflation or evidence for a primeval gravitational background of primeval gravitational waves. Thank you. I knew it took longer than I know. So, I mean, it's up to you guys. I'll gladly answer questions, but you're probably hungry.
I suggest we have a short question period.
As you wish. It's all up to you now. I mean, you now bear the burden of these people getting angry.
If you can bear waiting for lunch a little bit longer. So we have a tradition of always starting with student questions. So I'm going to first open the floor to the students.
And by the way, you're going to have to talk loud because my ears are stuffed from the airplane.
I'm going to, if you wait for the microphone, I'll bring them to you.
So at the beginning, you showed something that looked like a plus and cross polarization.
Say that again.
The first slide, you showed distortion of space-time, and it was a plus and cross polarization of gravitational waves. But if we have a left and right circular polarization, is the signal different? Can the detectors see this?
Yeah, let me tell you. I didn't lie to you, but I didn't give you the whole story, okay? There are, even in the very first paper that Einstein wrote, which was wrong in the way the sources made waves, but he wasn't wrong about the kinematics of the waves. He showed that there were two polarizations of gravitational waves of the kind I described, and they differ only by the fact that that pattern is rotated 45 degrees with the other. And you'll find out those are orthogonal to each other. And you can get rotations, you can get spins, you can get all the things that you want that you get in electromagnetic waves. You can get rotations, you can get orbital motion, you can do everything you can do with E and M waves, you can do with those. But you have to have both polarizations. And that's one of the things that was a big deal when Virgo came on the air. And that's the thing that you might as well know right now. And that is we had a decision to make when we designed LIGO. How should we make the orientation of those two detectors, the one in Hanford and the one in Louisiana? And we made a decision which was anti-science, but pro-politics, okay? And it was that, what it was that we decided that we want to make them identical in sensitivity for the same polarization and not measure the polarization. In other words, because we wanted desperately to make sure that we saw a signal and we want to exploit the idea that you had the same signal in both detectors. But we gave up a piece of science by doing that. Now, Virgo did not build to that particular form, and they're rotated. And they immediately gave us some polarization information. And that's going to be the case with all the other detectors as well. So we will, if we get the whole network working, not only will we get better resolution on the sky, but we will get polarization information as well. I think that's what you asked, isn't it? I think, yeah.
Are there questions from students?
You didn't talk about this that much, but do you think Kagra's cryogenically cooled mirrors is going to affect the sensitivity a lot, or is it?
Well,
what do you?
You know too much. That's the trouble with you.
Sorry.
She's worked on everybody who's worked on gravity waves. She and I talked a little before this talk, so she knows a hell of a lot. What it is that what she's referring to is the state of Kagra. And Kagra is an interesting problem. I don't want to go any more into it. I hope they work. I hope they work. But they've made some very bad compromises. They were internal compromises in Japan. They built the thing. One of the things they did is they built it in a mountain, and they built it at a 1-degree angle. And the reason they do that is a mountain weeps water all the time. And they didn't want to put channels in with pumps. I mean, I can understand what they were doing. So now the system has this terrible problem. That it has a 1-degree angle. The whole thing is it's not plumb with respect to gravity on any point of it. And that makes it much more vulnerable to thermal noise that I won't go into why, but it has to do with the curvature of the Earth. We have a little problem. The problem is that if you have two detectors and hanging by mirrors that are like this, and you're measuring between them, horizontal, the vertical thermal noise that shakes things up and down does not, to first order, affect this time it takes light to go between them. On the other hand, if they're hanging like this on a curved Earth, and they're shaking like that, that does happen. And it's vertical thermal noise is hard to get rid of. There's a complicated reason for that. So they made a bad compromise there. The other thing they've done, which is much more serious than that, is they've by making some insane rules, and I'll say this publicly, I hope there's nobody here from, yes, if there's somebody here from Japan, tell your bosses. what happened is that they made a really stupid decision. And the decision they made was, we have to be on the air when LIGO's on the air. They were just starting, for Christ's sake. But they made a rule, and so what they did, they didn't push through this cryogenics. They didn't finish. They demanded that the people who work on that project make a Michelson, a simple Michelson, which everybody knows would be thousands of times too insensitive to be part of anything. But they demanded, as a political thing, that they be running simultaneously with LIGO. And that wasted 2-3 years of good development time for them. And it burnt out a lot of people. I think that's what you're referring to in the end, but maybe you didn't know that. But so they made some, what I consider really absolutely asinine decisions. What happened is it cost them people in their project. And so I hope they recover from it. It was a political decision. God knows where that came from. And they have a very good chance of finding two things out which are very important to know. One is, does burying a detector really help that geophysical noise, that seismic noise? I'm not talking about the seismic acceleration noise. I'm talking about the seismic density fluctuation noise. Because that is supposedly going to be less, the Rayleigh waves don't go into that mountain as deeply, okay? The other thing is that they will find out, and they will not do well enough, unfortunately, but they will find out if cryogenics solves a problem that we have, which could be a problem not for getting to advanced detector, the design sensitivity of advanced LIGO. That I don't think it does need this, but for A+ and for all the detectors that follow, we have a noise which we have to learn how to control, which we have, which I'll tell you what it is. It's the thermal noise in the coatings of the mirror. That turns out to be, we can model that, turns out to be the dominant noise once you get to design in advanced LIGO. And what it is that the surface, when you have a multi-layer coating, you have 50 layers of dielectrics with different dielectric constants, and that gives you a high reflectivity. Those are the little blue things when you wear, you know, fancy glasses that have coatings on them. That's a multi-layer coating to keep it from reflecting. You want to make it so it reflects a lot, you add more layers, and you make it so that they reflect more and more. And that's how you get these very high reflectivity, very low loss mirrors. The trouble with those surfaces are they're not single crystal. They are noisy surfaces. They're surfaces that don't have a good structure. There are a lot of low-lying states in them. And so consequently, there's a lot of mechanical friction in those coatings. And there's a lovely thing that many of you probably thought was all theoretical, but has a tremendous application in LIGO. It's called the fluctuation dissipation theorem. And I'll end on that with, what is that? Because it's an important thing people know what that is. It says that thing which dissipates, in other words, the thing that takes energy out of a system, in a coherent, it doesn't have to be coherent or an incoherent way, is also the same mechanism that brings in the fluctuations, thermal fluctuations. And you can make a little model of that. That's real simple. Just imagine a mirror sitting in a partial vacuum. And here's all this gas hitting the thing. And so here's this mirror, and it's moving back and forth. And as it moves in the gas, it sees more atoms coming at it in the direction in which it's moving. And so it slows down. There's a viscosity moving that mirror. Okay, those same atoms, when the mirror is standing still, hit the mirror from both sides, but not always exactly the same. So those same atoms cause that mirror to jiggle around. You get the idea? The thing that dissipates the motion is also the thing that brings in the disorder. And it turns out you can measure the losses in the coatings, and they're high compared to the bulk material, the beautiful silicon dioxide the mirrors are made of. And so that's one of our fundamental problems right now, how to make a coating that has very low mechanical loss. And a lot of work is going into that. And that's something that the COGRA thing might help us with, because they're running in cold, and they have mirrors made of sapphire, and maybe their coatings won't have that problem. That's the best I can do for you. Yeah.
Thank you.
Let me open it up to any questions. Luis, can you?
Is there going to come a time where we're detecting so many sources that astronomers don't have time to sleep or look at anything else?
Yeah. You're asked the question that I call the fundamental limit question. That's really what it is. And I'll give you the analogy in a field I knew a little better when it got to be science. We designed measurements of the cosmic background with a mantra which was the following. Let's measure all the attributes of the cosmic background to the limit of the noise of the foregrounds. Okay? And that is indeed what happened with COBE and with WMAP and with Planck. That's, you're not going to do a hell of a lot better until you measure more better foregrounds. And you're at the limit now with those things, that making better detectors, only way you can win now is making more detectors so that it goes faster and you can think of more things to do. So you're asking me, when are we going to be at that limit with LIGO? And you can see the beginning of it with that cosmic background of unresolved black holes. And there will also be a background of unresolved neutron stars. It's a long way off, by the way. And the people who, and let me just tell you a funny story, and that's Peter Bender, who is a guy who I was on a committee I ran many years ago, took on LIGO, and took on LISA, excuse me. He is the maven of LISA, which, and for many years worked on it. And one day, he calls me up in a sort of a disturbed state. He said, you know, Ray, we have a terrible problem in LISA. We're going to be background limited by all those goddamn white dwarf binaries as gravitational wave sources. What do you think we should do about this? And I said, you should live so long, you know? Have a background of gravitational waves that dominates your back. That's a measurement. Come on. What are you worried about? Yeah, okay. That was in an earlier day. It turns out that was solved, and now it looks like, yes, there will be a very nice rumbling background in the LISA measurements of white dwarf binaries. But they will the black holes will stand out above those things. And then you can model some of that, but you can model it in a so it's going to be interesting. But yes, there is a limit that comes from an unresolved background at some point. I don't think we're anywhere near that with the instruments that we're talking about. I think that's the question you asked. I hope I answered what you asked.
More questions?
Yeah, they got hungry. You see what happened?
A density of fermions is thought to carry a torsion effect in general relativity. And I'm wondering, now that you can measure gravitational waves from neutron star mergers, whether these measurements will be sensitive to torsion effects.
I can't answer that. There are people in the room who can probably answer that right. I mean, I can tell you one thing, and the only thing I know of is that in all our modeling right now, the modeling of the black holes as a way of testing general relativity, for example, or any other theories of gravity, and in fact, even being able to see the normal modes of the geometry after the final black hole forms, all of that suffers from signal noise right now. We don't have enough signal. And there are ideas for doing that. Lewis has some ideas. We want to improve the detector. That's the best way I know how to do it. And so it turns out that whether one can see torsion or not, really in the end, I don't think anybody that I know of is talking about that, but I bet you, when you do the numbers, you will probably find that the system isn't good enough to measure that. That's my guess. We have to improve things a lot to see small effects. Right now, we can test general relativity to about 10%. That's the best I can say. You know, I mean, that's a very crude statement, that the kind of waveforms we have, do they match? I mean, you can do Lorentz invariant kind of our calculations. You can, you know, that different parts of the spectrum don't move at different rates. You can do a whole bunch of things, but they're not very precise measurements. And I'm quite disappointed that we're not able to see the normal modes of the metric ringing after the black hole is formed. That, to me, would be a measure that we really made it into being able to test general relativity.
Suggest that we go to lunch. But before we do that, let's thanks Ray again for a wonderful talk.